This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Book Show. I'm Claire Nichols. And we are up to book three on this year's Booker shortlist. Today, you'll meet Shehan Karunatakala, a Sri Lankan writer whose book has a detective trying to solve his own murder from the afterlife. Now, if you've missed the first couple of Booker conversations with Percival Everett or Alan Garner, you will find the last two episodes of The Book Show on the ABC Listen app, and there are more Booker conversations to come. My goal is to make you an expert on the shortlist by the time the prize is announced. But before that, it's time to spread a little joy. I first spoke to Andrew Sean Greer back in 2018. It was my first year hosting The Book Show, and to this day, it's still one of my favourite conversations that I've ever had on the program. Andrew had just won the Pulitzer for Less, a book that put joy at its centre. It was about Arthur Less, a bumbling and utterly lovable writer on this madcap trip around the world. Now Arthur Less and Andrew Sean Greer are back with a sequel called Less is Lost. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, Claire. I'm so happy to be back.
Yay. Early in this new book, it's called Less is Lost, we find our hero Arthur Less snort laughing at a funeral. What's so funny, Andrew?
I have to say that I was taking notes at a funeral I was at, and I think if you're anything like me, you know that those really tense, sad times are moments of incredible hilarity as well, because you have to release the tension. So I took notes, and I thought that's what happens. And the book starts with death, because I think that was what was on my mind, you know, these past couple of years, but it leads out.
Yeah. And so in this case, we're at this funeral and there's a men's chorale, a gay men's chorale, which is, you know, so-so.
The OK chorale. That is the worst pun, but everyone loves it. I'm so glad.
Why is he at a funeral? Who's died?
It's his old partner of 15 years, not his present one, Robert Brownburn, a famous poet, who was ill at the end of the last book and reaches the end of his life in this one.
Okay. Arthur Less, we got to know him in Less. He's this kind of supremely awkward man, a minor American novelist, a man prone to humiliation after humiliation. Why return to Arthur?
Well, I tell you, I didn't want to at first. I was planning a different book. I did all the research. I rented an RV. I traveled in the American Southwest for 3 weeks and the Deep South for 3 weeks because I was curious about my country. I clearly didn't understand it after the 2016 election of Donald Trump. And I thought, I'm going to go to these places. But I wrote 100 pages of that novel, and it was a terrible novel. And I just thought, if only I had a pre-made narrator and a ridiculous protagonist who could take me through the difficult thoughts I'm having. And I thought, well, I do. I already did that. I'm just going to do it again because it's the only way in.
We talked last time about how close Arthur is to you, how you've mined your own humiliations for this character. Is that a confronting thing to do, to kind of dredge up all the embarrassing stuff and put it out there for the world to read?
Well, the last book I thought no one would ever read, so it didn't matter. But this one, I'm aware people might read it, but I still did the same thing. I sat in my chair and I thought, what did you leave out of the last book? What was so humiliating you couldn't put it in? And those are in this one as well, including Arthur's first kiss.
That was your first kiss?
Yes.
Come on, tell us about your first kiss. Go on.
Oh, it was just awful. You know, this was a time of restricted love between young men, and I was in college, and there was a gay dance party, and a guy I'd met at the gay, you know, men's group, we decided we were going to go together. And we were going to meet in my, I was in a singing group. And so we had a room on the college campus and we were going to meet there and have some drinks and get our nerve up. And we just had too many drinks and put on George Michael, started dancing around, ended up kissing. I ended up, how can I put this delicately on a radio show? Kneeling before him. And he promptly vomited all of his drink all over me. And that was my first kiss.
Oh my gosh, that is a terrible start. And I think in the book, Arthur, you know, he gets really cut up because this guy doesn't really talk to him again. And Arthur wasn't even attracted to him in the first place, but he spends so long like bemoaning that guy.
I mean, it's too much. He took it too seriously, much as I did. And so I tried to turn it, you know, inside out for myself and for him. And so that we can laugh at it a little and see that it's something that should by now be a funny joke and no longer a source of pain.
But it's brave of you to tell these stories as well. Because, you know, like you say, you know, this time you've won the Pulitzer. People are going to read Less Is Lost. Are there moments where you go, oh, is it too much? Can I share it? Or should I keep that one to myself?
I don't. I think that's oddly, I have many flaws. And one of them is that I'm utterly vulnerable. I actually have no sense of dignity. But it's a plus in a way, because I don't mind telling you these stories on the radio, because I think they're funny. And I think it's nice for people to hear someone who is willing to laugh at themselves.
Sequels can be tricky things. What were your concerns about writing another Less book?
Well, certainly my agent said, please, Andrew, do not write a sequel to this book, because she said it's unseemly to write a sequel to a Pulitzer Prize winning book. But the other thing about winning that prize was the realization that I was now allowed to write whatever I wanted. So I went with it. But the hard part is you want to make a book that people could pick up if they hadn't read the other book. And you also don't want to disappoint fans of the first book by doing something so vastly different or killing off characters or making them into psychopaths. So you have something delicate in your hands now that I didn't think about before.
You also, the last book was a love story, and I'm going to try my best to talk my way around this without spoiling Less for those who haven't read it. But, you know, it was a very beautiful love story. And the thing about sequels is that couple that we see get together, something has to happen to that relationship in the second book. Did you get nervous about what you might have to do to this couple that we're all so attached to?
Yeah, it was hard. And my readers gave a lot of different advice that would have taken their fates in different directions. But I still thought of this as a love story, only it's the after the happy ending love story. And confronting what happens after that, the struggle to be a couple, the actual love story, not the get together, but the being together, which was interesting to confront.
So in the last book, our hero, our minor American novelist, Arthur Less, had to go on a big trip around the world. He accepted every literary invitation he received because he was trying to avoid an ex-partner's wedding. In this new book, Less Is Lost, he's off on a big trip again. Why this time does he have to go on the road?
Well, it's another nonsense excuse, but it's financial, because he's been living rent-free in his old partner's house in San Francisco. And if anyone's paying attention, prices have gone up in the city since the 1980s, and the estate is asking for back rent. And he has to somehow come up with this money, and writers don't have any money. So he looks around, calls his agent, he gets a gig. Then he gets another gig, and he's just piecing it together to also piece together his relationship with his new partner.
And he gets in an RV, which you said earlier you did as well. Come on, tell me a bit about this RV road trip. Where did you go and what did you see?
I don't have as decrepit an RV as I gave Arthur, though I have driven that kind of Westphalia. It's a difficult one. I had more of a American style Cruise America camper van. I had three different RVs. My rule was I could only go to small towns, and I had to sit at the counter if I went to a diner, and at the bar if I went to a bar, and I had to talk to the people next to me. and just not ask politics, but just ask them about their lives. And it was fascinating, truly fascinating.
Tell me about meeting people. You know, you're this San Franciscan gay writer. You know, how are you received by people in, say, Alabama?
Alabama. Well, I did. There is a scene in Les Is Lost where he goes into a rural bar that is very like one that I went into, thinking I was disguising myself as some hetero guy, clearly not from the South, but I can put on a Southern accent. My family's from the South. I went to Walmart and bought a baseball cap and I t-shirts and things. I didn't fool them for a second. They knew exactly who I was, where I was coming from. And they were chilly at first, but I won them over after a couple Bud Lights. And they were, it was charming in the end. I left before things got too rowdy.
That might be the secret to the Alabama bar. Leave early. Arthur Less does this too. I think, although his outfit he buys from Walmart's even more ridiculous, he grows this kind of big handlebar moustache and puts a red bandana on, trying to look as like hetero and South as possible. He's concerned. Someone said, oh, you know, I don't think they really like gay people in the South. I mean, is this something you had to worry about?
I thought about it. But I talked to my mother, and who's from the South, and she was worried about me. But she said, you know, if you call people sir and ma'am, everything will be fine. And that is what I did. I would just say, yes, ma'am, Bud Light, ma'am. And that worked. I think I was a neutral presence to people. You know, I'm not very, I don't ring a lot of alarms for whatever reason. So people accepted me.
And you said you went on this trip because you had questions about America. You had this kind of maybe big American novel you wanted to write. Did you find some of those answers when you were talking to people in these bars?
I did, although they're not explicitly in Les Is Lost, because it was painful and sad to hear people's stories and their dreams that didn't come true and their rage at the government, you know, things that I don't agree with or I have other explanations for myself. That was hard. And to go in places like the Deep South, where there is a sense of that something terrible happened here, that the people were enslaved, that there's still racism, that's, you feel it. But all of that is not exactly in the book. It is alluded to in the book, and it's trying to make fun of Les's reaction to it. And that was very complicated for me because I had conflicting emotions down there myself.
Yeah, I think you've taken a gentle approach here to politics. As you say, it's alluded to, but it's not explicit, because I don't think an Arthur Less book can do that. Do you think that other big American novel is still in you, or is that 100 pages as far as it will go?
I always think I'm going to write some 800-page epic, and I never do. It's always 250-page story about one person doing one small thing. I think that seems to be what I do, no matter what my thoughts are. I agree with you, though, that an Arthur Less book doesn't have ridicule of anyone except him, lovingly, and it isn't cruel, the humor, and so it can't be that partisan. It's by its nature, these books are full of empathy.
I should mention one recurring joke in the book is that every time Les meets someone out in the country, they think he's from the Netherlands. Why do they think he's from the Netherlands?
I mean, I think there's some queer people out there who will recognize this, that people ask you where you're from because they're hearing or sensing something different, but it's not part of their cultural experience to know what it is. I'm often asked if I'm British. That's one thing people ask me, and I'm super American. But what they mean is that they're hearing something different in my voice or the way I carry myself.
Wow. This book is narrated by Arthur's partner. And at one point, his partner tells us he comes home to find Les looking like a demon because Les has started a new novel. And the narrator says, I assumed, as many do, that the act itself would take place in some crucible of the soul and be no more of a nuisance than living near a typing school. Readers, this is not so. There may be writers whose imaginations are so fertile, they merely plant the seeds and water them regularly and a novel blooms every year or so. And lucky are those authors' partners. But all other writers, it seems, must provide their own manure. Andrew Sean Greer, what are you like when you're writing a novel?
I am a monster. And I put that in because I thought there I was in the pandemic working on this novel with me in a room with a bottle of gin and a boyfriend in the other room who had to deal with my self-doubt mostly and pacing around. And there wasn't very much far to pace. So I thought of him and how what a gentle soul he must be to put up with it.
You talk about, you know, you're feeling inadequate, you're feeling like you can't do it. But there are also these moments of grandiosity, right? Where you're like, I am a genius. Look how amazing I am.
Yes, of course. And then you look back and it's actually the reverse. The things that you hated are actually the most straightforward and well-written. And the grandiose, amazing statement about the world and the human condition is overblown and has to be cut. That's a nice correction.
You know, Andrew, this reminds me of the Australian author Craig Silvey. He's actually going to be on the show later this episode. But last time I spoke to him, he talked about this same thing, about how deeply caught up he gets in work, how difficult he is to live with. Is it something you wish you could change about yourself, how deeply you have to immerse yourself in a book?
Yeah, I certainly have friends who are less absorbed by it. They do their writing and then they're finished by 2 and they text me and say, hey, you want to go see a movie? And I'm like, I can't see a movie. I'm dealing with the demon of my soul, you know? And then an hour later, I've dealt with it and I write back, let's see a movie. And they're like, I'm already in here. So others seem to not suffer as much. But I'm sorry, but glad to hear there are Australian writers who do as I do.
And you said the word suffer there, but of course we've talked before about the fact that the less novels are books of joy. You know, this was your project, right? To write a novel that could be joyful the whole way through. So even when it is Arthur Less and it's joyful, it's still kind of a suffering process to write.
I hate to reveal it to the readers that it is. You know, I the struggle is mostly just to get it right for the reader so that they have a good time, you know? And it's certainly a great time. You know, you read that line about manure and I just cackled to myself and I took it out and I put it back in. And I think I eventually apparently left it in because I just thought it was too ridiculous. And those are great fun when you write those. But it's mostly the storytelling itself, like the order things go in and the pacing, that's maddening.
And I think your books are particularly challenging in that way because you are really shifting around. Our narrator can get a bit distracted and go off into a little story and then come back. I mean, what is it for you? Is it post-it notes on the wall? How do you actually figure out where everything goes in the end?
Well, it's a program that's basically index cards on the computer, and I just move them around and move them around because that's the hard thing is there's all these backstories I want to get in there that feel important for the emotional life of the characters or just so that to set up a joke for later. And I have to get them in the right places and make them feel natural so the reader doesn't even feel the shift.
Yeah, I noticed one. Actually, I went back to the start and I realized a little joke you'd planted on the first page of the book and I think summed it up on almost the last. It was pretty impressive.
Oh, good. I like that technique of trying to like nested eggs, the jokes and where they land.
You wrote this novel during the pandemic. Did the pandemic slow you down? Because various authors responded in various ways. Some couldn't read, couldn't write. Others found it a great time to settle. What was it like for you?
Well, the first 3 months, I couldn't read or write, for sure. If you look at my Instagram, I was posting way too much about what I was wearing. And readers were saying, work on your book. And then eventually I did. I had to get to Italy because that's where my partner and I live, but I wasn't allowed in until October of 2020. And then I just worked. Then it was a gratifying time. There were no distractions because there was no one's birthday party I was missing. There was no great restaurant opening, no new film, nothing. It was just us and the Fellini movies we on Netflix, which was hard, but also I look back on it as a great time of work.
I did see, and this must have been from that first 3 month period, I did see a video you did of you kind of swatting around, making cocktails and being a bit of a tech.
Yeah, I was doing at the beginning of the pandemic, I was doing 10 minutes with Andrew Sean Greer, and I had this sort of obtuse, arrogant character that I was making worse and worse cocktails as my ingredients ran out at home. And I interviewed like my mom and my brother.
That's so fun. I mean, some authors did some amazing things. Val McDermott started like a cooking channel where she was cooking recipes from her books. It was so cool.
I mean, it was a creative time when we weren't scared to death. We were bored to death. And so a lot of us turned to sort of making a little TV show out of it, which was great fun. And I think revealed unknown talents in writers that we know.
At one point in the book, Arthur Less is talking to another writer and they ask if it's worth it, if being a writer is worth it. And I guess that's my question for you, Andrew Sean Greer. You've said it's hard. You've said you're difficult to be around, yet you get to make these beautiful things. Is writing worth it?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I say that having survived and I'm out the other side of that one, but I'm into a new book now and it is a compulsion. I mean, I can tell that it's something that even though it's maddening for me, it gives me pleasure. And other artists, visual artists I talk to, it's the same. It's worth it. There's a reward. And the reward is on the page every day. This is lovely talking with you, but it helps me get through the day.
Andrew Sean Greer, your book is called Less is Lost. It's a sequel to Less. I loved it. It's published by Little Brown & Company. It's been so fun to talk to you again today.
And with you, Claire, thanks for having me on again.
Craig Sylvie will join me on the book show soon. He's got a new novel for kids that is every bit as joyful as Less is Lost. But let's get into the booker now. It's the second year in a row that a Sri Lankan author has been on the Booker shortlist. Last time it was Anuk Aridprakasam. This time it's Shehan Karunatilaka with his satirical detective story set in the afterlife called The Seven Moons of Mali Almeida. It's about a photographer who's trying to solve his own murder from beyond the grave during the ravages of the Sri Lankan Civil War in 1989. Shehan is speaking to the producer of the book show, Sarah Lestrange.
Shehan, congratulations on your shortlisting for the Booker.
Oh, thank you very much. It never gets old. It's been a few weeks, but yeah, still loving it. Yeah,
that's great. Now, before we talk about your book, it has been a difficult year for Sri Lankans with food and fuel shortages and political instability. How are you coping?
Yeah, well, I mean, what a month it was. What a few months it was. At the beginning of July, people were on the street and jumping in the president's pool, storming the castle. The president was fleeing. And, you know, we saw it all on our televisions and the whole world did. And then after that uncertainty, then we went straight into petrol queues, which were, I mean, you have to experience it to believe it. And then suddenly a Booker long list happens. So, and in the midst, you know, I was writing about what was happening and doing that. So yeah, it's been a surreal few months. Now normalcy has been well, you know, it's now the queues are less, there's some system in place, there's gas and, you know, there's food in the shops, there's medicine in there. So, you know, we're not panicking. But you know, with Sri Lanka, it can always just turn in a week, so you never know.
Well, that's good to hear, because the setting for this novel, The Seven Moons of Mali Almeida, is actually a previous political storm. So it's set in 1989. There's conflict on a few different fronts. Can you just give us, a quick history guide for what's going on in the background to your novel?
Well, it happens on page 27, I think. you've got a little two-page little cheat sheet.
Yes, thank you for that.
But it's strange. There's never been a shortage of things to write about. when I started writing, it was 2009. It was the end of the 30-year war. So there's plenty to write about then. You know, there's a lot of controversy over how the war ended and how the peace was being managed. But of course, you know, I wasn't brave enough to write about contemporary times. So I went to 1989, which I remember as a teenager being the darkest time in our history. And I think that's still the case. I mean, we've had a lot of uncertainty this year, but nothing in comparison. And yeah, the multiple fronts were, there was a ethnic civil war between the Tamil Tiger separatists and the majority Sinhalese state. So that conflict had been going on for about 6 years then and would continue well into the 2000s. But by 1989, there was a peace accord with India where India sent their peacekeeping force over. So we had boots on ground. And that, I mean, peacekeeping force, ironic term, because they ended up fighting with the Tigers. And so there was conflicts up north and out east. So I was in Colombo. So I think Colombo's always been a bit insulated from this. But while that was happening, there was a Marxist insurrection in the south of disaffected working class youth, university taking on the state. And again, it was a bloodbath in the sense that on one side, they were crippling the state and the state had their counter-terrorist units, which were abducting youth. So this is like heady stuff for a teenager going to school, that you had two wars effectively happening at the same time. But for me, and at the time, you didn't really understand it. All I could read was the fear on the grown-ups' faces and the fact that schools were closed and so on. So when looking back, I mean, from 20, 30 years later, one thing I felt safe about writing about this period was most of the protagonists and antagonists were dead. And this period had been well documented and, you know, both of those wars were effectively over. So, it just seemed like a very good place to set a ghost story because there wasn't a shortage of corpses or restless spirits. So, I dove straight back into the 80s.
Yes, and there are plenty of corpses in your book and plenty of gallows humour to go with it. So here we have Marley Almeida. He's our main protagonist. He's a photographer who's actually documented many crimes by many sides, and he finds himself in the afterlife after being murdered, he thinks. He doesn't know. Why a ghost story? Because then he sets out to find out what happened to me, why did I die, and who killed me?
Well, I think the reason I chose it, because I previously had written a cricket story about 10 years ago called Chinaman, The Legend of Pradeep Matthew. And I'd written it was a cricket detective story about Sri Lanka's greatest cricketer who no one ever heard of, a quest almost. And I didn't expect it to travel outside of Colombo or outside of the subcontinent, but I was delighted to see it did quite well. And suddenly I was called on to talk about cricket, and I wasn't really that much into cricket. I mean, I researched it for the novel, but you know, there are a lot of Sri Lankans who are a lot more obsessed about cricket than me. And so just I thought, okay, how I should do something completely different for my next trick. And then I thought what Sri Lanka needs is a great ghost story, because there's been plenty of other stories. But so I just started collecting ghost stories and researching tragedies of the past. So that was the motivation. But then I also realized that a ghost story, and like you rightly said, it's a whodunit. It's a photographer who had seen all sides of the various conflicts. So there wasn't a shortage of people who would be out to get him. It just seemed a way to discuss this complicated political situation through a ghost story, because the classic. So we had the seven moons, which is also rooted in spirituality. It's a Sinhalese and it's an Asian belief that the spirit hovers around for like 7 days before it goes on to its next place. So that was the ticking clock for the thriller.
So he's got 7 days to find out.
Yeah. So he's got 7 days, seven moons to find out and make peace with his former life. But also it allowed me to explore these various factions who might have wanted him dead. So the structure is very much a murder mystery, but set in the afterlife of a dead guy trying to find out who killed him.
And the afterlife is a curious place. It's very bureaucratic. What gave you that idea to have these people with their clipboards, and then there are others who are trying to subvert the bureaucracy as well? It's kind of just like being back on Earth.
So that was the tricky thing, because most ghost stories, most stories of the afterlife don't really reveal much. It's all, until probably the final act. So it's all mysterious and bumps in the night until you find out what happens. But mine, on page one, you meet the ghost who says, "Hi, I'm a ghost. this is how I got here. So I had to imagine the afterlife. And of course, that's quite tricky because, you know, you can go into near-death experiences, philosophies, religions, but no one really knows. That also allowed me to make up whatever I chose. And it just made sense. Having spent time in, you know, in passport offices, in parcel, in various government bureaucracies over here, and probably been writing down thoughts for this novel while sitting there, it just occurred to me that, yeah, of course, the souls have to be processed. And what's to say the afterlife's any more efficient than it is down here? And that made a lot of sense to me, that Sri Lanka's full of these restless souls who have to get a piece of paper stamped at some department and don't know where they're going. And perhaps that's why the reason for the chaos, because these restless souls are whispering in people's ears. And it was also comic enough for me to be attracted to it. Sri Lanka is a grim place, you know, most of the time, but it's not a sad, depressing place. It's not a dour place because we tend to appreciate the absurdity and the humor in it. So I think this was also a situation where the afterlife as a bureaucracy, where God or the creator has gone off for lunch and hasn't turned back, and people are just left in the queue, not sure what to do. It just seemed like a nice way to talk about Marley's journey as well.
And was that a way for you to also offset the horror of what Marley is seeing and reporting, what he's taken photographs of, to have that injection of satire and humor?
Yeah, I think so. I think, yeah, I do naturally gravitate to that sort of tone. But yeah, it did allow me to go to the darker places, because there's a very practical, right in the first act, you see the very practical craft of body disposal and how challenging it is. And these two goons were trying to figure out ways to dispose of Marley's body. So it was done in sort of absurd comic way, but it doesn't offset the fact that, yeah, there's a body being dismembered and the spirit is discussing it. Yeah, I think I do try and manage these two things, because otherwise, yeah. I think, as Sri Lankan said, better to laugh than to cry. And if you don't laugh, that's what you end up doing. And hopefully there are enough laughs in the book.
Yeah, yeah. And also we find out about Marley Almeida's personal life, and that's quite affecting as well. But I want to come back to this idea of him as a photographer, you know, bearing witness to these horrors. Is this something Sri Lankans are ready for?
Well, that was the central idea of the book that I was interested in exploring. And it's with us that we've had so many horrors and tragedies in our past. And there is this notion, well, should we dig up our past or should we bury it? And I think that's the conflict at the heart of the novel. And it's very easy for people who weren't affected to say, well, you know, those were all bygones, no point stirring that stuff up, let's just move on. But there are people who cannot forget. And I don't think we've had memorials for atrocities like 1983. So we're not very good at addressing our past, and we have very, very short memories. And so I think that was what I was interested in exploring. And same with Marley, he's got these photographs that show, and what he thinks will show the world, everything bad about Sri Lanka, and we will change. But it's a bit of a naive idea, because I think you're right, Sri Lanka doesn't like to address its past. But of course, there has been, when I wrote this, I wrote it before and during the pandemic, but since publication, there's been these last 3 months. And that's sort of given us a bit of hope, because these protests were run by the young. I mean, the young faced up to the bullets first up, and then we all joined. And it seems there is some sort of idealism, a sense of inclusivity, a sense, and that's what was wonderful about the protests, was that it transcended race, it transcended generations. And this is something we hadn't seen. We are a deeply divided country in our history. So maybe there is, maybe we are ready to face the past and all that. I mean, there was that sense of idealism, which has sort of tapered off now with the practicality of getting back to living. And to be fair, the state has demonized the protests, and a lot of their leaders have been arrested and taken in. So, but even though the book was written in a period where I didn't think Sri Lankans were ready to dig up their past, I think perhaps now there is a different mood in the air.
And what reaction have you had in Sri Lanka to your book?
Well, we can't ship books in here because it's not an essential service. So the books are, So it's a bit strange. Okay, so we had all this drama, and then my book comes out. I'm used to books coming out in anonymity. You know, you wait for the slow burn for it to get readers, but suddenly it comes out with a booker long list. So there's all this renewed interest, and I've been up all night answering emails. I've even had to tweet, you know, which I do once a year.
Commiserations.
So yeah, there's been all this attention. So we've been celebrating. The cricket team had a few wins. The netball team had some wins and this long list. So people have been getting behind it. But yeah, and the books have just arrived. I don't know how they smuggled them in, but they've just arrived in stores as of the last couple of days. So I don't know what the reaction to the book is. So far, yeah, the reaction to the shortlisting has been quite positive and encouraging.
This is the second year in a row that a Sri Lankan author has been shortlisted for the Booker. Is this an indication in any way of a thriving writing and publishing industry in Sri Lanka?
I think writing and I think publishing is catching up. And we're just talking about Sri Lankan writing in English. There's Sri Lankan writing in Sinhalese and Tamil. But yes, hopefully with Seven Moons, there will be more renewed interest in Sri Lanka and in the stories from here.
Well, Shehan, so good to talk to you and all the best for the Booker.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Shehan Karunatilaka with Sarah Lestrange. His Booker shortlisted novel is The Seven Moons of Mali Almeida. And next time, No Violet Bulawayo will tell you about her Booker shortlisted novel, which stars, among other things, Robert Mugabe as a frail old horse.
So it's not about imposing.
I'm not very good at reading for destruction.
I just know it'll happen.
There is this world I have in my head.
The Book Show with Claire Nichols.
Now, what a treat to finish off the show today with an author right here in the studio with me. It's Craig Sylvie. Hello.
Claire, hello. What a pleasure it is to be here again.
It's a pleasure to have you. Craig is the author best known for Jasper Jones and for Honey Bee. He's here with me now to talk about a novel for kids about a bright young country girl, her trusty dog Runt, and an international canine competition. And Craig, it's nice to see you so soon. It hasn't been so long since we were talking about Honey Bee. It seems like you've got this new novel written quite quickly.
That's right. I've pulled my finger out and, we're here a couple of years later.
So why turn to something for kids, something a little bit more gentle?
I'm a big believer that the right books find us at the right times. And I think this is true for writers as well as readers. I had the bare bones of this story in my bottom drawer for quite a while. But I hadn't had the opportunity to develop it any further. You know, my attention was drawn elsewhere. And then a couple of things happened. One is that I finished the final edit of Honey Bee and, you know, I found myself finally with a free creative slate after a number of years, and I was looking for something that felt like a departure, you know, something that was really quite different. And the second thing to happen was a protracted global calamity in the form of a pandemic. And suddenly, a lot of us found ourselves locked in and isolated and nursing some anxieties and economic concerns. And so it just felt right in that moment to reach down to the bottom drawer and pick up some notes and start spending my days in the very admirable company of Annie Shearer and her best friend, Runt. And I found it an enormously comforting, joyous book to write. I loved it.
All right. Well, tell us, who is Runt?
Runt is a stray dog of indeterminate pedigree who is rescued by a young girl by the name of Annie Shearer. And Annie is 11. She lives on a sheep farm in the town of Ups and Downs. And she has a penchant for fixing things. She carries a tool belt with her everywhere she goes. And they make a pretty formidable team. They adore each other, Annie and Runt. Runt is Annie's best and only friend. And by virtue of the fact that Runt has evaded capture for so many years living on the streets, he's a remarkably agile and athletic dog. And he also adores Annie. He'll do anything that she asks or bids, which makes them quite a formidable team when it comes to herding up the Shearer's sheep, which they often have to do because they're constantly breaking out, seeking greener pastures, which happen to be across the road in the verdant estate of one Earl Robert Barron, who, as villains go, is relentlessly avaricious and irredeemable. He has damned the local river and he's starved the town of its water. And he's attempting to collect all their properties, you know, one of which is the shearer's farm that he's coveting, which Annie soon discovers. And Runt tells a story of how Annie and Runt try to save their family farm.
It's a beautiful relationship between Annie and Runt. And I think we should hear a little bit about how they met. I hope you might do a little reading for us. So basically, Runt's hiding in the long grass at school. She sees him. She leaves him a sandwich, half of a sandwich. The next day she does the same thing, and the day after that, and the day after that, until one day he walks right up to her. Can you read what happens next?
I can. From her school bag, she removed a purple tin. At 99 cents each, Mush Canine Cuisine was the cheapest dog food she could buy. The photo on the label looked promising. An appetizing bowl of rich, succulent chunks of meat. So when Annie opened the tin and turned it over, she was surprised by the sad, pale tube of goop that slithered into her empty lunchbox. Runt glanced up at Annie, unsure what to do. She worried that he didn't like it. "I'm sorry, it's all I could afford," she said. "I bought it for you. I thought you might be tired of sandwiches. I hope it tastes okay. Eat it up. It's all for you." The moment she gave him permission, Runt ate hungrily. He licked the lunchbox clean. It was the most delicious meal he had ever tasted. When he finished, he looked up at Annie and wagged his tail. It was as though he understood the depth of her kindness. He sat with her for the whole lunch break. Then, when the bell went, the strangest thing happened. As Annie started walking back to class, Runt followed her, right at her heels. When she stopped, he stopped. And when she started again, he did too. Runt followed her all the way back to the classroom. Mr. Ranatunga, who was her teacher that year, stopped her at the door. "Annie, you can't bring your dog into the classroom with you." "I didn't. He just followed me. And he's not mine. I don't know who he belongs to." Annie looked down at Runt. Runt looked up at Annie. And at that moment, she knew they belonged to each other.
Oh. That's Craig Silvey reading from his novel, Runt. Are you a dog guy, Craig? Have you had dogs?
Not in recent years, but I grew up with a dog. Our roles were very much reversed. I was the runt of the family and our dog, who was an enormous German shepherd by the name of Bella, was certainly the person, well, the entity that I obeyed. But I adored her, and I am very much a dog person. I love dogs. I think they're fantastic.
You talked about Annie and Runt living in this country town called Ups and Downs, a town that's deep in drought. How's that affecting Annie's family? How's that affecting the wider community?
Well, it's put the town under a whole lot of pressure. You know, Ups and Downs was historically a very successful place. You know, it was heralded the world over for producing the finest wool. But in recent years, it's in a state of decline. Many people are moving out. Local businesses are selling up. And it's a town in decay. And one of those properties at risk are the shearers. And, you know, we get a sense of that financial pressure through Annie's parents, Brian and Susie. And Annie absorbs their woes, you know, and it's her nature to want to fix things. And she takes it upon herself, basically, to try and find a way out.
And the way she finds is she realises that Runt, this incredible dog who does whatever she asks, maybe she could enter him in a dog agility course. And these are these competitions that have become strangely popular on the internet these days. Tell us about what you've had to learn about the world of competitive dog shows.
Well, there's a bit of judgment behind that, Claire. I don't know if they're strangely popular. I think they're justifiably popular. I love them. I find them endlessly entertaining. You know, Annie discovers at a country fair this agility course, which is open to all dogs in the community, and you can win a cash prize. And so Annie realizes that given their skill set, they might have a competitive advantage. And so she enters. And at the end of that particular competition, she learns that were she to qualify for the Crumpets Dog Show in London, they would be vying for a cash prize that would by far ease their the financial strains that the shearers are experiencing. And so that becomes her aspiration to guide Runt through the many hoops and hurdles and tunnels of the agility course competition circuit to make their way to Crumpets. You know, I watched hours of footage. It was no chore, let me tell you. I was just as entertained by the dogs who didn't do quite so well as the ones that did. And, you know, I loved it. I found it endlessly entertaining.
So Annie wants to enter Runt into a dog agility course. We know he's an amazing dog. He does whatever Annie asks. Only problem is Craig Sylvie. He can only do it when no one's looking.
That's right. There's a spanner in the works, Claire, and it is that Runt will not move if anyone else is within eyeshot or earshot. And so this is a problem, given that the Crumpets Dog Show is spectated by thousands and millions worldwide, I should add, on broadcasts. And it's the biggest problem that Annie needs to fix. You know, we're led to believe that it might be stage fright, but the answer lies in something a bit deeper. You know, it's one of many issues that that poor Annie needs to contend with. The other one, of course, being our arch villain Fergus Fink, who
will stand at nothing. We need to talk about him. So we've got the one bad guy called Earl Robert Baron, and the names are so good. And then we've got our very dastardly villain, Fergus Fink.
That's right.
Craig Sylvie, this is a character who actually shouts things like shenanigans and strokes a white cat. I mean, this is kind of textbook bad guy, right?
Totally, totally. But, you know, there's a rich inner world to Fergus. He's not just an empty archetype. I feel for Fergus. He's battling with the pressures of legacy. He comes from a long line of Finks who have been very successful historically in the canine agility course community. And the baton has been passed to him. The relentless pressure of his forebears to match their record to win the national championships as well as Crumpets leads him to act in dastardly and desperate ways. And so when he sees this young firebrand, this team from Ups and Downs, Annie and Runt, you know, he'll stop at nothing to prevent them from taking what is rightfully his.
I did get shades of Roald Dahl from this novel. I remember last time we spoke, you mentioned that you'd been recording an audio reading of Matilda for your partner. So Roald Dahl was probably on your mind. There's even a chapter called The Magic Finger, which is one of Roald Dahl's novels. Is the ghost of Roald Dahl hovering over this novel somewhere?
Well, I think it must be. You know, I adored Roald Dahl's books as a child, as I still do now, as does my partner. In fact, we just had our first child 6 weeks ago, and her name is Matilda. And I think, you know, Roald's legacy lives on within me. I adore the way he writes, and I think the way it maybe influenced Runt's narrative voice is through these highly opinionated asides. You know, there are a mm-hmm. few digressions mm-hmm. in there where, you know, our narrative voice gets quite judgmental, but in a hopefully amusing way. And that's what I always loved about Roald. Sometimes he was a bit mean-spirited, and it really tickled my fancy at that age.
This book could be set in any point in time, I feel. It's quite a timeless tale, yet you anchor it quite solidly in the present day. Annie's brother Max wants to be a YouTube star. Can you talk me through your thinking around finding the time for this story?
Yeah, I always felt that it could be set contemporaneously. I think that's where kids want to read. They want to take, for example, Max's chief aspiration, which is to be a star on YouTube. I think if you were round up a few kids and ask them what their greatest ambition is, it would be to be a big deal on YouTube. And so Max is a budding daredevil. You know, he posts to his channel, which is ailing. I won't lie to you. He's struggling with subscribers, but he's relentlessly optimistic, as is Annie, about his prospects. So there are, you know, it does have a timeless feel to it. I agree. We are in a whimsical, quixotic place. We do feel a bit removed from modern life in some respects, in Ups and Downs, but there are intrusions of you know, where we are now, and technology plays a big role in where the story goes. So it was about blending the two, I think.
Another reason perhaps why it's so firmly anchored in a place in time is that you had a screenplay for this novel too, right? What came first, the screenplay or the novel?
Strangely, because I do things in the oddest way possible, I kind of worked on both of them at the same time. And they both anchored each other and assisted each other. You know, screenwriting is a very rigid, methodical way to present a story. You can't leave much room in the margins. It's difficult to justify diversions when you're writing a screenplay, put it that way. However, in order to explore a story and let it breathe and to create it and develop it, there's nothing better than a novel to let you sit inside it and let the story come to you. And so I think the screenplay helped me keep on track, keep the story humming, but writing the novel helped the story come to life.
That's fascinating. And what's happening with the screenplay? Are we going to see Runt on the big screen?
Very hopeful. I'm contractually not obliged to tell you about recent developments. Unfortunately, I'd love to. But look, it's looking really positive that we might be hurtling towards production, which would be wonderful.
I loved reading this book, and there were a few delightful surprises in there. One of the things I noticed was the name of one of the dog trainers. It's Perry Wilson. And I recognise that name because I deal with Perry all the time, because Perry is a publicist at Allen & Unwin. She is your publicist at Allen & Unwin. Do you do this a lot, sneak in names of friends or colleagues into your texts?
There are lots of little Easter eggs and in-jokes and cameos in my books, absolutely, and those people know who they are. They're usually pretty happy about it. You know, I adore Perry. She's just the most wonderful person, and her dear puppy, Rufus, sadly passed away. And so as a tribute to the two of them, I gave Perry and Rufus a moment of triumph at the Woolarama show. So she's now enshrined in Australian literary history, as is Rufus, which was, a lovely gift that I could offer.
Are there any other names I should be looking out for in the book?
Oh, I'll never tell. Well, you might be the next one. Who knows?
Fingers crossed. I've seen you getting a bit nostalgic on Instagram this week because you're celebrating 20 years of publishing. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
How do you reflect on where you've come from and what might be next?
I think beyond anything else, I feel enormously grateful. How lucky I am to have such supportive readers and to have had so many people bless my stories with their time and their patience and to give so much of themselves to a book that I've written. I feel so grateful for that. I can barely string the right sentence together. I just feel very, very fortunate to be able to connect with strangers, across a void via a constellation of letters. It's the most beautiful thing in the world. And I feel very motivated to get better and to keep writing. And, you know, as long as people will read them, I'll be writing stories.
Craig Sylvie, what a joy to speak to you today. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Claire. What a pleasure.
Craig's new novel for kids and for adults too is called Runt. It's published by Allen and Unwin. We've been talking today on Whadjuk Noongar country, and the book show is also made on the lands of the Wurundjeri people. I'm Claire Nichols. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.